is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Tuesday, March 3rd, 2020. I'm Buster Olney. I'm at Yankees camp. Taylor Schwenk and Troy Farkas back in Bristol manning the board. Today is an all-access day for ESPN. We have the Yankees and Red Sox playing an exhibition game here in Tampa. It'll be on ESPN, and all day today we've had players, we've had executives, manager Aaron Boone on the mic talking back to us during the course of today's game. We've got a lot of players lined up to talk back to us. It's a fun week for baseball coverage with ESPN. They had an all-access day on Monday in that Angels and Cubs exhibition, and Anthony Rizzo was mic'd up as he was taking in at bat. Jessica Mendoza talking to him from the booth.
What are you going to throw?
What do you got?
I have no idea. I wish I knew. Someone banged for me. I'm feeling a heater right here because I've only seen one today from him.
Oh. I'm going to go to here. No, I'm not. Wow. That's good math.
Yeah, so that was awesome. And today it was interesting. It was in the Yankees clubhouse just a little while ago. And players are coming up and saying, wow, that was really cool with Bryant, Rizzo mic'd up and what they were saying. And how about that line by Anthony Rizzo? Someone banged for me. Obviously, a reference to the Houston Astros and the conversation we've been having all winter. Jessica Mendoza was on with Golic and Wingo talking about how she feels like vigilante justice will be a thing this year, but maybe a little less than what people think.
I wouldn't be surprised if the Astros are the most hit team in baseball as we get past spring and get into the regular season. That wouldn't shock me at all. It wouldn't surprise me if it does continue. Should it continue? Absolutely not. I don't think it's going to be as big of a storyline. I don't think guys are going to get plunked all the time where it's just gotten to where it's out of hand. But I think there's going to be some pitchers that are like, look, I'm pissed. Like, this is not something that, and instead of using my voice or coming out and saying things that like other players, I'm a pitcher and I'm going to back you off my plate and I'm going to show you. And I feel like, in and around baseball, you talk to a lot of guys and people are mad. And I think that comes out in a variety of different forms. And if people are going to think that that's the way to handle it, I don't agree with it, but I wouldn't be surprised if it continues.
Yeah. And I think she's right on the mark. I don't think it's going to happen as often as people think, but I do think it'll be happened because of the anger that she referenced. In the Reds exhibition game on Monday, Trevor Bauer was pitching. And by using his glove, he was signaling to the hitters what he was going to throw. That got a lot of attention. Derek Dietrich, his teammates with the Reds, talked with Fox Sports about Bauer doing this.
Talking about Bauer giving up what he was throwing to Beatty there, and you have an answer for this?
In fact, I do. Trevor and I are good friends, and if you follow baseball this offseason, there's a little thing going on with sign stealing. So Trevor's not too fond of it, so he figured he's going to try something new this season, and he's going to start telling the batters what's coming, and that way there's no, no ifs, ands, or buts about what's going on. Just here it comes, try to hit it.
Well, he put a charge into one. I'm not sure I would recommend it throughout the season. One batter was fun, though.
Yeah, his fastball was playing up, and he looked good. And we'll see. You never know. Trevor's always going to do something nuts, and, we enjoy him, so it's pretty cool.
Yeah, this is getting a lot of attention around baseball today. And let's face it, if the Reds were playing in a regular season game and Trevor Bauer signaled to the hitter what he was going to throw and they lost the game because of that, the Reds probably wouldn't like that very much. Taylor, of all the all-access stuff that you heard yesterday, what was the most enjoyable thing that you saw?
I loved Rizzo and Bryant hanging out on the field, chatting it up. I mean, it was just kind of like, it was almost like a podcast on the field. They're telling stories. They're walking walking the announcers through what they're doing, like step by step. I mean, it was pretty wild stuff. I mean, that's things I would, never consider. I've never played baseball, so I don't know what it means to catch a grounder or anything like that. So it was very cool.
Yeah, today in our game, we're going to have Brett Gardner mic'd up. I believe in the top of the second inning, Rafael Devers. We're going to be speaking with him from his position. Alex Rodriguez will be translating for us. Zach Britton, I think, is scheduled to wear a microphone while he's warming up to come into a game. Perhaps some other players that we've talked about might drop in. So it's going to be absolutely a fun day. We talked about in recent days, today we're going to be doing a preview of the American League East. We'll be talking with beat reporters from all around the division to get a feel for what's going to happen. But before we get to that, do you ever feel like ticketing websites make getting to the event difficult on purpose? It's as if they're so big they can get away with not caring about the customer experience. So what if their site's annoying and doesn't have the events you want? Hello, status quo. The real question is, how easy could it be if those ticketing sites actually cared? With millions of live event tickets and a price match guarantee, SeatGeek proves there's a better way. Search sports, live music, comedy, and more. SeatGeek has the tickets you're looking for all in one place. They built the fastest way to find tickets, so you can stop searching for the perfect seat and start enjoying it. Why is SeatGeek better than the rest? A quick look at the App Store shows over 50,000 five-star reviews. How's that for customer satisfaction? It's a better process. SeatGeek pulls together millions of tickets from all over the web. Then it rates each deal on a scale of 1 to 10. Finally, SeatGeek displays them on an interactive seat map, breaking down the details. Green dots mean good deals. Red dots are overpriced. And every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets with confidence. I have the SeatGeek app on my phone. It's by far the fastest and easiest way to find tickets. I just used it the other day to get a seat to a Foo Fighters concert in May. I'm looking forward to that. Also, got one to see Sheryl Crow in April. If you're eyeing up an opening day ticket for your favorite team, look no further than SeatGeek. Good news. SeatGeek will give you $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase. All you need to do is use our promo code. Download the SeatGeek app today and use promo code BUSTER for $10 off on your first purchase. That's promo code BUSTER for $10 off your first purchase. Rock Abacco covers the Baltimore Orioles for Mass and Sports and Rock. Look, we all know what's going on with the Orioles. They're still in the process of rebuilding. So just big picture, how long from where we sit today in spring of 2020 before you get the sense that they'll really begin to turn the corner, not necessarily at the big league level, but as an organization?
Yeah, I mean, they're certainly moving in the right direction. And you talk to anybody in baseball and they'll say that. Now, when that translates to them being contenders, that could be a few more years. Certainly not expected again this year, maybe not even next year. But you see the progress being made. And a lot of it, it's not just on the field. I mean, it's what's going on behind the scenes. It's what they're able to do, you know, internationally, the analytics department, prospects. They're starting to get more talent, kind of the pipeline going. They've been drafting very well in recent years. All this is pointing to future success, but still, this is going to be a while.
Does it feel like there's more cohesion between the front office and ownership in terms of doing day-to-day work?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everybody seems to be on the right page, the same page. And, you know, Michael Elias has full authority here. And we were told that from day one, that, you know, he's running the show here. His fingerprints are all over the organization. These are his hires. He's making these decisions. And he seems to be involved a little bit in everything, but now he's also been able to finally get some people in place where he can step back a little more and concentrate more on the roster than building an analytics department with Sig or looking on the international side with Kobe Perez. I mean, he's got guys in place now, but it's been a process. But it just seems like everybody's on the same page, and ownership has stepped back and they're letting him run the show. They put a lot of trust in him. And, you know, clearly he dazzled them in his interview. I mean, he was ready. PowerPoint presentation from the get-go, and they were joking about that. He really wowed them. And so far, he's lived up to everything that he's promised.
Give me the name of a young player who could dent the big leagues this year for the Orioles.
Ryan Mountcastle, I would think so. The question is, where does he play? You know, he needs a position. He was drafted as a shortstop. They've tried him at third. They moved him across to first. They put him in left field. We may see him some in right. He's mainly been in left field so far in camp. They take some ground balls at first, but that bat plays at any level, and they will find a spot for him. But he'll start out in AAA. They're not going to go on record and say definitely, but that's the way it looks right now, and there's going to be a point in the summer where he comes up. And unfortunately, this organization, this team, are filled with corner outfield, first base DH types, and he's another one. They think that's a special bat, so wherever they can put them, they'll be glad to do it, and then they're going to have to figure out how they're going to make room, what happens to a Trey Mancini in right field, a Chris Davis at first base, or Renato Nunez at DH, but they will make a spot for Ryan Mountcastle.
I read your stuff on massandsports.com, and there's a lot of Adley Rutschman conversation, the number one pick from last year. What's a reasonable timetable for him to reach the big leagues?
2021 at some point. I mean, he's not going to make it this year. In fact, we're not even sure if he's going to be in low or high A ball to start out. because you only got a handful of games at Low Delmarva. So they may put him back there, or they may put him at High Frederick. But certainly by the end of the year, he should be at least a double A. But they're not going to push him beyond that to get him to the majors this year. But next year, if he doesn't break camp with the team, which he probably wouldn't, certainly at some point that promotion's coming. And so far, and again, relatively small sample size, but he's lived up to the hype as a 1-1. He's really impressed. And, you know, he's in camp here. He'll probably be among the first round of cuts, but he just blends in so well too. He's a confident kid, but he's not cocky. He's not arrogant. He's not turning off the veterans. They've really embraced him. He's eager to learn, but he certainly doesn't look wide-eyed and scared or intimidated by anything. Came from a major program at Oregon State. He's used to the attention that came with being one of the top players in the nation and a 1-1 and scouts following him. So he's not fazed by any of this. And, you know, he's a threat at the plate behind it. I mean, he's got special skills. At some point in 2021, we're going to see him.
I was surprised they didn't release Chris Davis at some point last year. What do you see in the organization's handling of him as we move forward?
Yeah, they just keep it. Michael Eich has said this multiple times that, you know, he's got a contract. We're aware of it. And they're, you know, respect the length of it. It's still 3 years left. They take it very seriously. So does he make it through it this entire season? We don't know, but certainly the rumors were stamped out during the offseason when it was thought, would they release him over the winter? And it was like, absolutely not. He's going to be in camp. And again, small sample size, but, you know, he's reached base all five plate appearances and has an off-the-field home run. He came in 25 pounds heavier, but good weight, as he said, very muscular. If nothing else, it's getting his confidence back. He said his weight dropped to 212 last year. He was 215 when he graduated high school. He said a lot of that was stress. He thought he needed to be leaner as he got older. And he's just going to go back now to being that hulking presence that he was before to see if that helps mentally as much as physically. So he starts the year with them, and then, you know, you see what happens. If he's struggling big time by the break, maybe they have to make a tough decision there. If he's playing really well, then maybe all of a sudden he becomes a trade chip. Who would have thought that? Maybe you eat enough of that contract. Maybe some team's willing to take them in exchange for a contract that they want to move, and something could get done there. So it could be, you know, a win-win. But he'll be on roster opening day, and we have never told any kind of timetable of, you know, he's got this many more games to prove that he can turn this around or not. It's just we keep being reminded of the contract and how many years are left on it.
Yeah, last one for you. Breaking news, the Orioles will be sellers before the July 31st trade deadline. Who are some other tradable assets on their roster?
Yeah, they've got a few. Yeah, Trey Mancini is a guy that draws some interest, not as much because, you know, again, first base, corner, outfield, and there are a lot of those types. But he's a guy because of the way he hits, and he's certainly serviceable at any position and a great clubhouse guy that draws some interest. But Michael Givens, who didn't do well in the ninth inning closer role this past season, but really good numbers in the eighth. He could be a dominant seventh, eighth inning type guy. And there's been interest in him in the past, and a few winters ago, basically teams were told he's off the table. Well, he's available. They're checking the market for him. They did it on the offseason. They did it last deadline. They had talked to the Cubs about him at one point, I believe. So, I mean, there's definitely going to be interest in him if he has a good first half, and that's a guy that they could move. And maybe Renato Nunez, who is mainly a DH, but a guy who hit 31 home runs and drove in 90 runs this past year. If a team's looking for a bat for the second half, and the Orioles need to clear that spot because, again, they have enough DHs, then certainly he could be a guy on the move.
All right, Rock. Thanks for doing this. Great to talk with you.
Hey, my pleasure.
Alex Baer covers the Boston Red Sox for the Boston Globe. And, Alex, let's start with this about the Red Sox. After a tumultuous offseason, the trade of Mookie Betts, how good do you think they could be?
It's a really interesting question. I'm reminded in some ways of the team entering the 2013 season when they vastly exceeded expectations and projections. There's still a really good talent base with a number of players who are above average to kind of star caliber potential performers. When you look through the lineup and even at the top of their rotation, but with so much uncertainty and so many moving parts, there's a lower talent base than there was last year, and there's probably more anticipated variability with it. Could they be a playoff team? Sure. Could they also have a season that goes further off the rails than last year's did? Absolutely.
Now, when I was in camp recently, Chris Sale sounded very hopeful about how he feels physically. Nathan Eovaldi looked great in his first appearance of spring. What do you see in those two guys early in camp, them being so important to whatever the Red Sox do this year?
Yeah, Chris Sale is going to start the year on the injured list. He was slowed for a couple of weeks by his recovery from pneumonia, of all things. But he actually, he continues to feel great as he works through his early spring progression and feels like he's in a very different spot than he was entering the season a year ago when, as we all recall, coming off the shoulder injury, he had a slow start in spring training. He only had two spring training starts. This year, they aren't taking any shortcuts. They're starting him on the injured list in order to get him six full spring starts before he gets into the regular season. And he sounds like he feels ecstatic, honestly, about where he is physically, and he's kind of excited to be back to pitching at 100%. He's a little frustrated by the slower start, but that's a huge one. And then, of course, Eovaldi, you know, the arm is still just amazing. He's touching triple digits in his first start of the spring. It's always going to be a question of command with him. He wasn't healthy enough, strong enough last year to be able to command that fastball and to have all the secondaries work off of it. So he feels like he's in a better place to start this year than he was for most of 2019.
Give me the name of a key young guy in their organization to watch this year.
Well, the guy who's immediately opening eyes in camp is Jarren Duran, who's a center fielder. He was drafted in the seventh round in 2018 and immediately started hitting at a level that vastly exceeded what he had done in college. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been a seventh rounder. He was hitting 400 last year in his first couple months of high A, struggled a little bit in double A, but he can fly. So he draws immediate comparisons physically and in terms of that speed asset to Jacoby Ellsbury. And in camp, he's been hitting the ball in the air a little bit more with some authority. He hit an opposite field homer yesterday in a game in McKechnie Field where, as you know, the ball flies if you can get to the air. But, you know, there's some interesting upside there. And obviously, you know, in parting with Mookie Betts, they've created some opportunities for guys in the outfield moving forward.
If this team outperforms expectations in the first 4 months as in the playoff hunt, how aggressive will they be in augmenting the roster before the July 31st deadline?
That'll be awfully interesting. It's hard for me to think that they would go too heavily after rentals per se, but they want desperately to contend, right? And to prove almost as a face saving measure, they can't take half steps if they're in contention and kind of, you know, and back off given how, you know, that would look terrible for them. So I think that they would be willing to be, you know, aggressive for guys who they could keep under control for more than a rental period, but I'm not sure that they would have the same motivation as, let's say, the Yankees or the Dodgers, teams that are desperate to, you know, to break, you know, decade or multi-decade championship droughts.
Any chance that Alex Cora comes back as manager in 2021?
Well, I guess we have to figure out if he's going to be allowed by Major League Baseball to be a manager in 2021. His relationship with the organization, like the affection that remains for him in the organization, is very obviously enormous. It's kind of hard not to wonder about that. You know, I asked Chaim Bloom about that point blank on the day that he named Ron Renneke the interim manager. And he said, well, that wasn't a part of the thought process with this particular move and that, you know, Alex has to, you know, need some time away. But I don't know. There's a pretty natural fit for him back in the organization. Certainly no bridges have been burned. So I'll put it this way. It certainly wouldn't shock me to once again see Alex Cora as a Red Sox manager one day. Whether or not that's in 2021, can't say. Whether or not it ever happens, I can't say. But I wouldn't dismiss it.
I would agree with you. And a guesstimate on wins for the 2020 Red Sox.
As you know, Buster, I truly hate this undertaking because I took the hit on it pretty badly. You know, I think that I'll go for a middle of the fairway. I will predict, since they won 84 last year, I think improvement will happen over that. I think that they will have 85 wins this year.
I got the sense that you were going to pick that number. I just had a sense on it, Alex.
Becoming predictable then.
Well, I appreciate your time on this.
Great talking to you, Buster.
Before we continue here, I want to give you a little bit of advice. If you haven't yet, check out The Right Time with Bomani Jones every Tuesday and Thursday. Bomani only hits on the biggest stories, and this week, true to form, he's talking NFL Combine and a story in my personal wheelhouse, Public Enemy, firing Flava Flav. Talk about a serious workplace issue. Download and subscribe to The Right Time with Bomani Jones wherever you get your podcasts.
Sweeney Murdy covers the New York Yankees for WFAN, for SNY, and the MLB Network. Sweeney, you and I have seen players who've come to New York and they have struggled. Sonny Gray is a recent example. Back in the day, it was Ed Witts and Kenny Rogers. And I think a lot of casual fans will wonder what kind of a transition is Gerrit Cole making?
I think you have to look at CC Sabathia as a kind of a blueprint for that. Sabathia is, I mean, pretty much the same track, Buster. You look at track record and big money and the expectations of trying to deliver a championship to a team that hasn't won one in a long time. That was in 2009 when he arrived. The Yankees haven't won one since. Gerrit Cole comes into this. He's not going to be as wide-eyed as maybe some of the guys that were acquired by trade, like a Sonny Gray or Javi Vasquez or things like that. Maybe guys that just didn't pan out. Jeff Weaver is another one. But Gerrit Cole accepted a lot of money and devoted basically the rest of his professional career to pitching here. I think he knows the stakes, so I don't think he's going to at least mentally be in the same position that these other guys are that we talked about.
How big of a concern is the Aaron Judge shoulder issue that popped up early in camp?
I think you have to look at everything that keeps Judge off the field, even if it's a little bit of time in February, as somewhat of a concern, given what he's been through the last 2 years. And even in his rookie of the year season, Buster, he had a shoulder issue, the other shoulder, that kept him in the lineup but unproductive for a very large portion of the second half of that season. And he stayed in the lineup because the Yankees were dealing with other injuries at the time and needed to keep his bat in the lineup, and he kind of struggled through until he was able to really get things going again in September when the shoulder was healed a little bit better. So because he's missed so much time the last two seasons, anything that's keeping him off the field is going to be a bit of a concern. He has to prove to the Yankees again that he can play 140 or 150 games a season.
Gleyber Torres shifts from second base to shortstop this year. What do you see in that transition for him?
He's played the position before. He came up as a shortstop. The only thing that would worry me is just the consistency of his play. I think he saw a little bit at second base. There were times for all of his skills and all of his tools and his ability. There were occasional lapses in the field, and I think those will show up more if they are indeed still part of his game. They show up more at shortstop than they do at second base. Just simply what coaches call finishing the plays. And that's more specifically on throws or, you know, just not getting, you know, making sure you're not kind of playing back on the ball, things like that. So just making sure you're ready for every play. We talk about how young he is all the time when we see him perform offensively. That is part of the deal defensively, too. So maybe another year of experience here and knowing what's at stake for the Yankees and maybe just the importance of being their shortstop. Maybe some of that stuff goes away. But that's something that I would be looking at early on with him.
Give me the name of a young player that you think could manifest in the big leagues for them this year.
That's a really good question. I think the idea right now is, you know, Mike Ford touched the big leagues last year, and I think he's a pretty good bet to get some significant playing time this season. The Yankees lack a true backup first baseman besides Ford. Their best defensive first baseman is DJ LeMahieu, and he's going to be playing second base. So if you're looking to pair somebody with Luke Voit, Ford profiles well from the left side with power. We all know how left-handed power plays at Yankee Stadium. And he's a guy who was a very patient hitter all through the minor leagues. There was up until a point in AAA, he had walked more than he struck out in his minor league career. And that's something you don't see very often these days. I think they like that offensive profile. I think his time to be on the big league roster, open the season on the big league roster, is definitely here. And I wonder if you say give him, I don't know, 250 at bats, what he might be able to do and the kind of power he might be able to provide to this team.
We've seen the injuries hit again early in spring training. If the Yankees, and this is more of a rhetorical question for you, if the Yankees have holes leading up to the trade deadline after spending $324 million on Gerrit Cole, how aggressive would you expect them to be?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're always there, you know, and the problem is everybody wants them to make a move now. You know, who's starting pitchers in February? Nobody. Nothing happens until July. We all know that. Even when the Yankees have their biggest needs, and it's very well known in April it's their biggest need, they still won't make the trades until July. So I think we're all going to be watching very carefully to see what pieces become available. Yeah, I mean, we know what's at stake here. The Yankees haven't won since 2009. That's a lifetime, some people. Some poor 10-year-old Yankee fan out there has never seen his team win a World Series championship. and his parents are spending a lot of money on tickets, and they want to see something happen.
And lastly, before you go, give me a win guesstimate, we'll call it, for the 2020 Yankees in the regular season.
You know what's funny, Buster? I was just thinking about this. The Yankees have lost Luis Severino and are down Giancarlo Stanton to start the year at the very least. They didn't have even one of those guys really last year, and they won 103 games. So as people get all up in arms about what these early injuries are over again, you didn't lose anybody that you missed last year. This is a 100-win team. It really is. And I think that's really all I ever look for. This is a team that can win 100 games, but we know what's really important around here. It's the last 11, and we'll see if they can do that.
Perfect. Sweeney, thanks for doing this.
You got it, Buster. Thank you.
Mark Topkin covers the Tampa Bay Rays for the Tampa Bay Times. And Mark, as you know, the Rays last year, 96 wins, came within one victory of making the American League Championship Series. If you look ahead to this year, who in your mind is kind of like their linchpin guy, the guy who could be the difference between them making the postseason or not making the postseason or perhaps challenging the Yankees for the top of the division?
Well, I mean, when you talk about the Rays, Buster, you're always going to talk about the pitching, and the potential of the big three they have right now is pretty overwhelming. If Charlie Morton can do anywhere close to what he did last year, if Blake Snell and Tyler Glass now can stay healthy and do what they did in stretches last year, that really puts them at the top. They've made a couple of changes offensively, maybe a few more than we thought, but I'm going to give you maybe a little bit of a surprise answer, and I'm going to say Willy Adames, because he's a guy who really came on last year for them, the shortstop, the young shortstop, emerged as a team leader, emerged as a frontline player, both offensively and defensively. And he's a guy that I think really has the potential to be a huge part for them. Brandon Lau, you could certainly make a case for, had all-star numbers in the first half, missed most of the second half. The new Japanese outfielder, Yoshi Tsutsugo, has been very impressive and has both a lot of talent and a personality. But now that I covered myself with seven other runners up, I'm going to go with Willy Adames.
Tell me what you've seen in him this spring and heard about him this spring or at the end of last year that makes you feel that way.
Just the confidence he has. I mean, he was a guy who at the beginning of last season, I think, thought he could be good, but didn't know it. And I think he put a lot of work in. Rodney Linares, who was the new infield coach last year, he's back again this year, played a huge role in Willie's development, did a lot of the drills that he did with some of the Astros players when they were coming up, when he was in their minor league system with, you know, guys like Altuve and Correa. And he really helped make Willy Adames a great player. But I just think the confidence, when he was in the minor league, they referred to him a lot as a Pied Piper kind of guy. He was the guy that a whole team would rally around, a whole clubhouse would look to, you know, during those tough days and those tough moments. And I think he's a guy who could have a huge impact. And, you know, again, the fact that he's an everyday player is a big part of that too. But I just think he's a guy who could really, you know, as far as you said, making a difference kind of guy. I mean, it's easy to pick on, say, Kevin Kiermaier if he stays healthy and things like that. But I think Willy Adames is a guy that there could be a pretty good swing there. And another guy too is Jose Alvarado. I didn't mention him, but more of as a reliever, obviously, with less of a, you know, daily role, but has potential to impact the team if he's really healthy and back and of the right mind.
Now, I was following you around at Rays camp recently, and what jumped out to me just going from field to field, like, oh, there's a good player, and there's another good player, and there's another good player. You have literally covered every year that the Rays have been in existence. How would you compare the depth of the 2020 Rays to other teams that you covered?
Yeah, I mean, it has to be right up there because they are good and they are deep and they have alternatives. They have different ways they go with things. And so the depth they have both, you know, at the major league level, you know, let's say 1 through 35 of those players, but also the depth they have organizationally now is just remarkable, to where they're taking a guy like Lucius Fox, who at one point was one of their best middle infield prospects, and they had him in center field the other day to see if they could expand his versatility. So that's where they are depth-wise and talent-wise at all levels, really.
Now, you know this from talking with executives of other teams. The Rays within the baseball industry are regarded as among the very best run teams, and that's reflected in how many people I hired out of the organization every offseason. I think the Rays and the Indians have, you know, lead the majors in brain drain, so to speak, where there's absolute drain out of those organizations. How has that not had an impact on what they do?
Yeah, it's remarkable. And you just, you know, you think back this past offseason, obviously Chaim Bloom hired from the Rays, who is now the chief baseball officer for the Boston Red Sox. James Click hired from the Rays, who is now general manager of the Houston Astros. And those are two guys, Buster, that started as interns here. I mean, so I think, you know, the credit, it doesn't necessarily go to the intern coordinator, but it goes back to, you know, willing to take a chance on bright young people and willing to stay with them, give them responsibility, let them grow. And Eric Neander, who's the general manager now, has, you know, referenced that several times, that, you know, they like to stay within. They like to promote from within. Stu Sternberg, the owner, is a big proponent of that. So, you know, you got to guess right. Not everybody obviously develops, but maybe almost akin to how they develop, you know, young players, they develop young executives here. And, you know, there's now four teams, you know, including the Rays, being run by Rays type people. There's seven managers that have Rays connections currently. And, you know, obviously there have been some others. Mickey Callaway is one who comes to mind, but predating the current regime. There's just been so much, though, with the group here. And as you say, a little bit of a brain drain, but also the fact that they have the depth. They empower these people. They allow them to be creative. They allow them to just make suggestions. It's not an authoritative ruling here. It's always, things are always done by decision and discussion. And I think all that is reflected on not only on the success they've had, but as you say, the people that have moved into leadership roles with their teams.
And one thing that jumped out to me just being in camp that day, man, those guys have a blast. The players, I mean, that culture that Eric Neander, Kevin Cash have fostered just seems to be so positive. Again, from your experience in covering baseball, how would you compare it to others?
Yeah, and you know, the best way is we hear that from players who come in all the time, and even sometimes from players who leave and go somewhere else and say, hey, man, it ain't like that everywhere. It's a little different. And Tyler Glasnow, you know, has made no secret of it. He's, you know, contrasted the relaxed atmosphere the Rays have to what he had experienced previously under a different regime in Pittsburgh. And you know, night and day isn't enough to separate how he said those differences are. And it is. It's a culture that, you know, Joe Maddon should get a lot of credit for, that he started when he was brought in here by Stu Sternberg, Andrew Friedman, Matt Silverman. That was, you know, their first hire when they took over to run the team starting in 2006 at the end of 2005. And they wanted that culture, and Kevin Cash has done a really good job continuing it. He thinned out. He doesn't like to do the quote unquote silly stuff. They don't do the road trips and things like that. But Kevin Cash's idea of a culture in the clubhouse is really simple. Just let guys be relaxed, have fun. And when it's time to play, play really hard. And you couldn't make it any simpler than that. And it's really worked very well for them.
All right. Give me a guess on a win total for the 2020 Rays.
In the regular season, I'm going to go somewhere in that 92-93 range. I think, you know, getting a 96 last year, even with all the injuries they had, was pretty remarkable. And, you know, there's still going to be some bad teams to beat up on, but I think there's some other teams that have gotten better. So I'm going to say 92, and I do think they'll be in the playoffs.
All right, Mark. I appreciate it.
All right, Buster. Anytime.
Rob Longley covers the Toronto Blue Jays for the Toronto Sun. And Rob, look, everyone's excited about the young players the Blue Jays have put together. For 2020, I think the question everyone is asking is the rotation good enough, the improvements they made during the offseason, good enough for them to begin to compete with the top three teams in the American League East? What's your view on that?
I guess we'll see, Buster, but it's certainly dramatically better than it was last year. I mean, this is a team that had 21 starters last year, and it led manager Charlie Montoyo to have the infamous quote one day when we asked him who was starting on Tuesday. 2 days later, he said, an opener and a guy. And he said that more than once last year. So, I mean, obviously having Ryu as the ace, I mean, I think that's a huge thing to build on. But more importantly, they've got some innings eaters in there with Tanner Roark and Chase Anderson. And then a bunch of guys battling for a fifth spot. And if Matt Shoemaker comes back to the form that he was in his brief stint last year before he blew out his knee, then, yeah, I think this rotation is certainly enough to give them a little bit of momentum and give these kids some confidence that if they put up a number of runs in the game, 4 or 5 runs, that they're going to have a reasonable chance of winning just about every night out.
Because of the pedigrees of Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Bo Bichette, Kevin Biggio, they get more attention than a lot of the Blue Jays young players. Tell me what you've seen in them and in year two for them in the big leagues.
Well, it'll be interesting to see on a number of levels. I'm just writing about this today, actually. I think we can expect an even bigger season out of Vlad Guerrero Jr. I mean, there was so much hype on this kid a year ago when he was probably the most recognized prospect in the game, certainly the top-ranked prospect in the game. And it might have been a little bit much for him to handle. Now he's got Bo Bichette, who came up last year and made a huge impact. Kevin Biggio, who did to a slightly lesser extent the same kind of thing. And now Ryu as an ace starter. There's a little bit of the spotlight is off Vladdy. And I think he's really at ease with himself. He had a good offseason workout-wise. He's dropped a little bit of weight, but more importantly, he's trimmed up and muscled up a little bit. And I think he could be sleeping on a really good season. And as for the other two, Bichette and Biggio, you know, you want to talk naturally about sophomore slump, but there's something about both of these guys that makes me think that's not going to happen. I think part of it is because of that pedigree that you alluded to, Buster, the fact that they've been around major league clubhouses most of their lives with their fathers. But also, each of them, both of them, worked through some slumps last year. They're very smart kids. They're very dedicated in terms of not only improving, but working their way out of things. And I wouldn't expect much of a sophomore slump from them. And I think the momentum that they showed last year is going to continue into the season. There's a real good, strong vibe around this team with all the young kids. They fit in well together. They've won in the minor leagues together. And I think that's worth something.
When I was talking with Jeff Passan last week about the Blue Jays, I mentioned to him that I feel like that as much as we talk about those three guys, maybe the most important guy in the organization among the young players is Nate Pearson. Just because, you know, a big question for the Blue Jays moving forward is who are going to be the anchors with a pitching staff if you're going to compete with the Red Sox and the Yankees, teams that, you know, typically spend more money. What have you seen in him this spring, and what do you expect from him this year?
Well, I don't think we're going to see him until the summer, although if I were a GM, I'd be tempted to maybe rush that along a little bit. But I've seen him pitch live twice now, Buster, once in a bullpen session over at the complex, and yesterday when he made his debut against the Yankees. The kid threw 12 pitches yesterday, 9 strikes, struck out the side, and he was brilliant in doing it. They don't have the radar gun working here at the renovated TD ballpark yet, but a couple of scouts I talked to said that he hit 99, which is pretty good to be doing in February. But more importantly, I think with the gauge of what he was throwing yesterday, all you had to do was look into the Yankees dugout and take a look at some of the faces of some of those players in there. It was almost like they couldn't believe what they were seeing. I mean, obviously he's well known as a guy who can hit triple digits regularly, but the people you talk to who face his live pitching talk about the life on that fastball, not just the speed of it, but the life of it on it. And I think that he, you know, he's showing all the signs of being a massive impact player at some point. He'll be the first sort of homegrown Blue Jays starter that they've had in decades now. And they're managing him carefully. He pitched 101 innings last year, and they want him to start in AAA Buffalo and you know, prove at that one final stage before they bring him up. But I think everybody in the organization recognizes this guy can be a stud starter for a long, long time. And Blue Jays fans can't wait to see him. It'll be quite a sensation, I think, when he comes up, because everything you read about the guy is true when you see him pitch live. And when you talk to him, you see a grounded, dedicated professional that's pretty much wise beyond his years. I think he's a superstar in waiting.
What's on the line this year in 2020 for Ross Atkins, his manager Mark Shapiro, who, of course, heads up the organization?
I think improvement. I mean, I think they seem to have the endorsement of the owners, Rogers Communications. But, you know, at some point, you got to turn it around and move in the right direction. And they've been in a steady decline, not just in the standings for the past 3 years, but in Rogers Center attendance. So, you know, this is a team that just 3 years ago led the American League in attendance, and now they're you know, plummeting towards the bottom. I don't think that pressure is immediate. I think that they've sold the ownership group a blueprint that's essentially a 5-year plan. But I think they do have to take a step forward and move forward from that 95 loss season last year, and at least show to the ownership and the fan base that the team is headed in the right direction.
And last one for you. Give me a guess on a win total for the Blue Jays in 2020.
Well, the smart guys in Vegas tell us it's 75.5 is the over-under. And as a wise guy, part-time gambler myself, I think I might go with the over on that. I don't know that they can get to 500, but let's say they can get to the shadow of 500. I'd, I'd put them at 80 wins this year.
Rob, I appreciate your time on this.
Well, my pleasure, Buster.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Tuesday. Jimmy Yogurt at DJ McG10. Jimmy Yogurt is super excited about Chipper Jones joining Wednesday Night Baseball. Better than a tattoo, he gave him his highest honor by naming his home Wi-Fi network after him. Which player turned commentator has wowed you in the booth?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you, I'm excited about Chipper. When he was playing, I would always make a point to go by the Braves camp in spring training, and I would ask him every spring, what's caught your eye? And it was amazing to me how good he was at identifying a great player, a great situation, something was going on. For example, there was a spring training when Jason Hayward and Freddie Freeman were in Braves camp, and we were all talking about Jason Hayward and how many home runs he was hitting. And Chipper told me, he said, yeah, Freddie Freeman, you know, he's going to be the guy who's going to wind up lasting a long time and isn't going to be an elite hitter. He nailed that one. And I remember one spring him telling me, yeah, that guy's the best shortstop I've ever seen in my life. That was a 19-year-old Andrelton Simmons. Already Chipper identified him with that.
Can't wait to hear him on Wednesday Night Baseball.
Yep.
D at JD Yank Pack writes in, with the new three-batter minimum for relievers, what are the chances of gamesmanship and relievers feigning injury illness so as to get a better matchup with upcoming hitters? I feel like that's pretty likely.
Yeah. Well, maybe, but I think that's one of those things that we always think about, you know, as sports writers and as fans, and then the players won't actually execute it. Remember, Major League Baseball is going to be watching this situation very closely. And you do wonder if you see a team do this repeatedly, all of a sudden a guy, you know, has the flu or something like that, and he's pretending he's throwing up on the mound or he's saying he doesn't feel well, and they make a pitching change in a key spot in the eighth inning. I bet you there'll be complaints from the other team. So I don't think it's going to happen as much as maybe we think.
Joey Carbs at Carbs 86. He writes in to ask me, before the Orioles had the biggest hill to climb, what player that is no longer with the team was most gut-wrenching to see go? There are two answers to this. Number one, Mike Mussina, of course, back in the 90s. That was brutal. But watching Manny Machado go and watching kind of the Orioles not really make a serious offer to him and try and retain him, that was pretty tough to stomach.
Do you feel like right now there's a player that you can root for, that you can get behind?
I like Trey Mancini. And honestly, yeah, I like Chris Davis a lot. I hope that he can play well, and you know, he's never going to live up to that contract, but I just want him to see him happy playing baseball. That's it.
I would agree with you on that. I do think that this could be a year in which they actually decide, you know what, we're not going to get more production out of him, and it's time to move on.
Last one, Andrew Campbell at Real Camp Drew. Is it crazy to make an early prediction that Gleyber Torres might be a dark horse candidate for MVP? He's projected by many smart people to possibly have a monster year, and the potential injuries to guys like Judge and Stanton give him more room to shine.
I would agree with you. I did SportsCenter this morning, and they asked me what I wanted to talk about, and I said, let's talk about Gleyber Torres, who I think is the big X factor. Moving to shortstop, which he did last year. They like his defense, but this is a really confident player. Had a terrific year last year, 38 home runs, and he's just 23 years old. So, yeah, I could see him winning the MVP.
Right on. That is Bleacher Tweets for Tuesday. Hope you enjoy the divisional preview today. Thursday, we will have the NL West. Next Tuesday is the AL Central, and next Thursday will be the NL East. So there you go. There's the lineup.
And my thanks today to all the beat writers who joined us, as well as Taylor and Troy. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. Enjoy All Access Week for Major League Baseball and ESPN.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.